This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, we are going to learn about an online program to help people with gambling addiction get the help that they need, and it comes to us from Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota. But first, we are going to learn about the upcoming Game Changer Ideas Festival in Bismarck coming up on October 13th, and we have two guests on the phone from New York is Dr. Dhruv Kular. He is one of the featured speakers at the Game Changer Ideas Festival. Dr. Kular, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And in our Bismarck studio, we have Kayla Schmidt. She is the program coordinator for Humanities North Dakota, which puts on the Game Changer Ideas Festival. Kayla, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Kayla, the word game changer is in scope quite a big word. Why do you use this word for this festival?
So we really want to challenge the ideas that people have about all range of topics. This is our fifth year, and we've covered everything from the Middle East and journalism and criminal justice last year. So we really want to say, what are the big things that make people curious? And then how do we make them think differently about it? What's the game-changing way that we can really look at this? And who are those people that we can bring in to talk about it?
So what are your resources for something like this? That seems like something difficult to just Google. Hey, who's cutting edge on?
A lot of time, that's where it starts. and then, you know, we look for book recommendations, podcasts, what's in the news, what's happening. And so far, it seems to be working, whatever we're doing.
And this year's theme is health and happiness. What made you want to explore topics related to health and happiness?
I mean, a lot of our past topics, we've gone for more of the big ideas, the concepts, the very humanities-driven things that you think of as traditionally being a humanities program. But we wanted to bring it a little closer to home. So the one thing everybody has is a body. That's what the human-humanities kind of connection is. And so there's things you can't escape. So we're looking at aging. We're looking at dying. We're also looking at how do you find happiness. This is something, you know, Americans are very preoccupied with is how do I be happier? So we really want to kind of start looking into that concept.
Well, and that leads us to one of the featured speakers. Dr. Dhruv Kular is at New York Presbyterian Hospital, where he is an attending physician, and you are also a researcher. And Dr. Kular, a lot of your work is on purpose and meaning in life and how that can affect health. And interesting that Kayla would use the word happiness and the pursuit of happiness, because some people sort of use the terms a meaningful life and a happy life interchangeably, and you're not one of them.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, one of the things that I've seen as I've treated patients over the years is that those who have something outside of themselves, those that have some source of meaning, whether it's a job or it's a child or a parent or a loved one or a cause greater than themselves, they often have a better time of it. So they're able to deal with suffering, deal with the things that come up in their lives because they have something else outside of themselves that they're living for or that they want to see happen. And one of the distinctions I did want to make when I talk about this issue is that things like purpose and meaning and well-being, they're actually slightly separate than what we think of as happiness. And so purpose and meaning, they're kind of a deeper state. They're more durable states. Whereas happiness or feeling good is a little bit more superficial and it can be more transient. And so an example that I give is someone like a pediatric oncologist, a cancer doctor for children. That's not a very happy job, obviously, but it may be a very rewarding one. Parents often find that raising a family is the most meaningful thing in their lives, but some research has actually shown that a lot of times when you're interacting with your children, you're not necessarily as happy as you are when you're exercising or watching television, but it is very meaningful. And so meaning and purpose are slightly different than happiness.
And do you put forward that purpose is something that we find, something that we create? Do you know what I mean?
Well, Yeah, exactly. And so one of the points that I think is important to recognize is purpose isn't necessarily something that you're born with or that you stumble upon. It's something that you can really develop and hone over time if you have if you pay careful attention to it. So there's been a number of studies that suggest that, you know, when people engage in meaningful conversation with their loved ones or with their friends, when they do things that are good for others, things like volunteering or extending a helping hand, when they find a cause that's greater than themselves, all these things can help them develop meaning and purpose in their lives. And so it's not necessarily something that you sit back and you don't have purpose on day one or day 10 and you think, you know, that's just not for me. It's something that we can actively build into our lives. And I think that's a really important lesson for everyone.
And how can we build that into our lives? I mean, I'm sure it's different for everybody, but is there sort of a rubric that you use?
Yeah, it is different for everyone. And it might be different for children and high school students. It might be different for people kind of who are in middle age. It might be different for elderly folks. There are some things that have been shown kind of across the spectrum to be helpful. So one is engaging in meaningful conversation with people that are close to you and asking questions about what is important in your life, how you've gotten to where you are, what your goals are for the future. Those types of conversations can be very helpful. Another is doing things for other people. And so volunteering, for instance, is one of the strongest purpose builders in one's life. And so there's a lot of programs that now exist, particularly for older folks. For instance, there's one called Experience Corps, which is an organization that trains people who are over the age of 55 to tutor children in public schools. And what it's found is that people who end up tutoring children, they have huge improvements in their mental health, their physical well-being. They have more social connectedness. They can have better mobility and stamina. And the kids end up doing better as well. And so it's kind of a win-win all around. So I would say a good place to start is having those conversations with people that are close to you. Intentionally doing things that are kind of outward looking, finding causes or things that are beyond yourself. And the last thing I would say is just keeping at it. You know, it's not something that is often epiphany, something that happens quickly that you can just download from the App Store. It's something that's a long and arduous process. But really, at the end of the day, it's one of the most important things that we can do for our health and our well-being overall.
How do you study the health impacts and the health outcomes of purpose and meaning and how that affects your actual health?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of work in this area. So some studies, for instance, they survey people or they enroll people in trials. And so they'll enroll a number of people at baseline and they'll ask them a lot of questions and they'll follow them over time to see how they do. And so one study found 1,000 individuals who did not have dementia and did not have any cognitive issues, and they followed them over the course of a decade. And what they found was people who had a greater sense of purpose were much less likely to develop Alzheimer's. They were less likely to develop other, even minor cognitive problems. Another study worked with children or high school students who were trying to volunteer with elementary students, and they would help the elementary school students with homework or cooking or arts and crafts, and they compared these to high school students that didn't do those things but that were on a wait list to do them. And what they found was over time, the teens that volunteered, they had lower levels of inflammation, they had better cholesterol profiles, they had lower BMIs, and the teens that had the biggest jumps in their empathy and altruism scores, they had the largest reductions in their cardiovascular risk. So there's a growing body of evidence that suggests that building this type of meaning into your life is good for your happiness, your well-being, but also your health at the end of the day.
Well, those things do all sound, you know, on the surface level, definitely very fantastic. But as a doctor and as a researcher, I assume you have to do a lot of work with relative risk and sample size too. And so just wondering, like, if you say teenagers, they had a lower risk of cardiovascular trouble after volunteering, but compare that with what really is the risk of cardiovascular problems with teenagers?
So obviously, you know, with teenagers, the measures here were not cardiovascular outcomes, because it's very unlikely that someone in their teenage years or their 20s would have a cardiovascular event like a heart attack or a stroke. And so those are kind of intermediate markers, things like cholesterol and inflammation. But when you look at older individuals, people in their 50s and 60s, you know, studies have found with large sample sizes. So there was a study with 6,000 people, for instance, and they followed them over the better part of two decades. And what they found was people who at the beginning of the study period had high levels of purpose found on surveys and questionnaires that they were answering, they were 15% less likely to die over those two decades. And so they found that having a sense of purpose was protective in terms of your lifespan. So there's been a lot of different studies and different populations, and the upshot of that work really is that there's protection for mortality risk and particularly for cardiovascular risk.
Kayla, how did you come across Dr. Kular's work, and how does it fit in within the theme of health and happiness?
It was a little bit of that Googling type of thing. So each year, you know, we pick the theme a little bit ahead, and we just start looking who is the up and coming, who's the expert on these issues. And one of his articles came across, I don't know if a board member sent it or if we saw it on Facebook, but we were like, this is the guy we need for this event. Just because a lot of these points about engaging conversations, that's exactly what we're here to do too.
Dr. Kular, do you draw a distinction between passion and purpose?
I think they're very strongly correlated often. And so generally when people have passion, when they are passionate about something or someone, that leads to purpose. So I think they're slightly different constructs, but very closely related. And having passion about something can be a clue. If something sparks your interest, if that is something that you continue to follow along and become more and more devoted to it, it often leads to purpose and meaning. And so I think passion can be a nice signal early on that, hey, this is something that will lead to meaning in my life.
I get the sense in your work that you have a lot of different facets that are all just slightly different from one another, but very much interconnected.
That's right. And I think, you know, one of the things that I'm interested in looking at is obviously health care is important, and medical interventions and drugs and devices and surgeries and procedures. These are all important things for our health. But what I'd like to have more of an acknowledgement of is that there's all sorts of things in our daily lives, whether it's meaning and purpose, whether it's our social connectedness with others, whether it's investing in our communities. All these things actually contribute to our health as well, and often can prevent a lot of the things that happen down the line. And so I think we all need to pay more attention to how we're living our day-to-day lives as opposed to just when we're interacting with the medical system.
And does it make much of a difference if what you are feeling is very meaningful and very purposeful in your life is, you know, what society agrees with is very purposeful, that you should be volunteering to read to blind veterans versus somebody who is surviving because they adopted a cat?
You know, that particular issue hasn't been studied in a rigorous way, but my inclination would be to say that it doesn't matter. It's not necessarily the case that you have to do X, Y, or Z that has, you know, been stamped by somebody or by society at large. It's more what gives you meaning and purpose. Where do you find passion? That could be something as small as, you know, taking care of a plant or taking care of pets at home. That could be something as large as, you know, volunteering or starting an NGO or an organization. That part is much less important than having passion and having purpose to begin with, whatever the ultimate cause is at the end of the day.
There is an article on Second Thought, which is published by Humanities North Dakota, and it's an essay adapted from one originally published in the New York Times. And in it, you talk about meaning-centered therapy and support-focused group therapy. Set us up with what those mean and what differences you found in the outcomes of meaning-centered versus support-focused group therapy.
Exactly. And so this study was one of cancer patients that had metastatic cancer and had a limited life expectancy going forward. And what the trial was trying to get at is what types of support groups are most helpful for these people. And they contrasted two types of groups. One was a meaning-centered group, and the other was a support-focused group. And so the support-focused group, they met once a week, and they discussed things like the needs for support, how to cope with your medical tests, how to talk to your doctors and your nurses. The meaning-centered group were quite different. They focused on spiritual questions. They focused on existential questions, things like what made you who you are today, things like what have you done in your life that you're proud of and what do you want to do going forward. And what the researchers found was that people in the meaning-centered group, they had fewer physical symptoms. They had a better quality of life. They felt less hopeless. And ultimately, they wanted to keep living more than the people in the support focus group. And so this is an example of how just talking about meaning, how engaging with others about the issues that are important to you can be really helpful for people who are coping with really difficult times in their life.
So we've been talking a lot about how patients can use meaning and purpose to impact their lives. But it seems to me that there would be a lot of applications for your research in teaching doctors and nurses and all the healthcare professionals with how to interact with those patients.
That's right. And, you know, not just doctors and nurses, but I think professionals and other folks generally can really benefit from these types of exercises. So, you know, in the article, I also share an anecdote of something that was incredibly helpful for me as I was going through some of the difficult times during medical school. And a group of three other friends and I would sit down every Sunday evening and we would turn our phones off and we would have a beer and we would talk very intentionally about the most challenging parts of our week and the most rewarding parts of our week. And I think those conversations, they helped us identify where there's meaning in our work, but also create meaning in our work. And these were some really tough experiences. So, you know, we might be caring for a child who passed away, or we might feel guilty about having committed a medical error of some sort. But these types of conversations were really helpful in getting through that. And so I think for doctors, nurses, other clinicians, it can be really helpful. But I think for anyone who's interested in these issues and who wants to find a way to build more meaning into their lives, it can be a really effective strategy.
Kayla, what do you hope that the presenters learn from each other at the Game Changer Festival?
It's always interesting to put all these different like schools of thought together on stage and see what they come away with. And so far, every time, you know, we've talked to someone, they're like, I can't wait to meet so-and-so. So really, we have such a cool lineup. We go really from like children and identity all the way through death, really. So I think at any stage, we have a lot of different questions, and the expertise all of these speakers have, I think, really bounce off each other in an interesting way. So it'll be exciting for our attendees to see that.
Dr. Kular, has that been your experience? You have been quite a well-sought-after speaker in your field. Are you able to engage? And I know you have quite a busy schedule, but are you able to engage when you go to events like this? And what do you try to learn from these?
Certainly. I think it's, you know, one of the best parts of these types of events is to learn from the other speakers, to learn from other folks that are presenting on topics that are related or often even unrelated to what you're talking about. But I also find it incredibly rewarding and instructive to learn from audience members. And so some of the most interesting conversations I've had when giving talks or when going to conferences, have been engaging with people who are in the audience who have incredibly interesting experiences to share and ideas to share. And so those have been some of the best experiences that I've had at these types of conferences.
Kayla, what are some of the other speakers? You've mentioned that we're going to be talking about death and we're going to be talking about aging, but who else is on the docket?
So we've got Andrew Solomon, and he is the writer of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. So he really looks at how, you know, oftentimes when people have children, they have this expectation. This is what our relationship's going to be like. This is what it's going to look like. But if those children are diagnosed with, say, autism, or they become a criminal eventually. He looks at all kinds of different situations in which the expectation does not meet the reality and the rewards and challenges that that can present. We also have another Andrew. Dr. Andrew Weirman is a historian, and so he's looking at the ways in which a lot of our healthcare debates have been going on since we've really become a country. And so some of that historical perspective can help give us a little bit of an idea of where we've been and maybe what we can shift a little bit this time around. Of course, we have Dhruv. We're so excited. Ashton Applewhite is an anti-ageism activist, so she thinks we really should get out and have some age pride. So the one thing we have in common is we're all getting older, and we just need to embrace that and really be a little bit more aware of how we treat people who are older than us, because it's all a cycle. We're going to be there someday too. And then, of course, we have our mortician, which is Caitlin Doty. And she has a little web series, Ask a Mortician. She's written a book about her experiences, and she says she's a funeral industry rabble rouser. So we're going to have an interesting look at what, in North Dakotans, we really, either somebody who won't stop talking about dying, or people who don't want to address it at all. So it'll be interesting to see how she gets us to all come together.
And you have had some auxiliary events. September 7th in Grand Forks, there was a staged reading of an adaptation of a book of poetry, A Beautiful Hell, and this is a book that chronicles the loss of a son.
Yeah, so that was kind of our kickoff in Grand Forks, and we'll also be presenting that same performance October 12th at the Heritage Center as well. So if you missed it in Grand Forks, we're bringing it back, and then we'll have the author of that. It's a book of poetry. She's from Fargo. Her name is Carol Kapowin-Rochensky. So she'll be there afterwards, the performance with Monica Hannon, they're both going to discuss, the themes that we really address, and kind of a difficult subject matter, but there's also some pretty funny parts too. So I think that's what we have to remember in a lot of these tough situations, is you can find joy and humor even if there's sad and loss and grief.
And maybe even find a little meaning and purpose, right?
A little bit.
That's right.
How has the Game Changer Festival changed in these few years? It's now in its fifth year.
So I think we try to change the setup every year too. So whereas we might have a meeting of the minds one year or a panel of some kind, this year we're doing a little bit more of just outright presentation, and then trying to get the audience to engage a little bit more, adding things like plays so people can address these difficult conversations in a way that's not so direct. Last year with criminal justice, we had a sheriff's deputy and rapper who did a one-man play, and so he showed a lot of difficult topics, but in a way that was interesting, game-changing, if you will. And so that's it. We try really each year to expand, to bring in new ideas. We try and find people in the community who are also doing this game-changing work and feature them as well.
Kayla Schmidt is the program coordinator with Humanities in North Dakota, and Dr. Dhruv Kular is one of the featured speakers at the Game Changer Ideas Festival coming up October 13th in Bismarck. And you can find out more about all the speakers and get tickets at GameChangerND.com. Kayla, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dr. Kular, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Still to come on Main Street, a recovery program for problem gamblers. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Hurricane Florence is a Category 3 storm expected to reach landfall in the Carolinas and Virginia by tomorrow. While evacuation orders are in place, volunteers are heading into the storm. 9 people from the Red Cross Dakotas region are en route. They're taking two emergency response vehicles of the five total the region has. Lynn Sparrow, Regional Red Cross CEO in Fargo, says it's possible they will need to send all their emergency response vehicles to the Carolinas and Virginia. Last fall, the Red Cross Dakotas region sent all their emergency vehicles to different parts of the country getting struck by hurricanes.
The Texas area for Harvey, and then in Florida for Irma, and then for, you know, Nate and Maria out in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. So we just we do the best that we can using the intel that we have to try to determine, you know, where these are going to hit and how can we be staged to be most helpful.
Volunteers got the call up a few days ago and are expected to provide relief for 2 to 3 weeks. The two candidates for North Dakota's lone U.S. House seat squared off in a debate Tuesday night. Republican Kelly Armstrong and Democrat Max Schneider found some areas of agreement, but differed on issues such as federal tax cuts and the Affordable Care Act. Both said they were willing to set aside party loyalty to work towards bipartisan solutions, but they also sparred on that. Max Schneider talked about his record in the legislature about working across the aisle to get things done.
North Dakota's member of Congress can't just talk about setting aside politics. They've got to do it. And this is a race for Congress where one person has shown they're willing to stand up for North Dakota. I intend to do that if I'm fortunate enough to get this job. And one person is going to stand loyally with the administration, even on policies that hurt North Dakota, like trade and health care.
Kelly Armstrong said he, too, has a record of working with Democrats, and he took issue with Schneider.
No offense, Mac, but you were not a bipartisan moderate in the North Dakota Senate. You were a partisan Democrat. And on big issues that were important in North Dakota, we worked forward and we passed issues that I think have benefited North Dakota significantly. And I have taken on members of my own party right here at home, and I have no problem doing that in Washington, D.C.
The debate was broadcast on Prairie Public. And North Dakota's Human Services Department is working on a redesign of social service delivery in North Dakota. State Human Services Director Chris Jones says the purpose of the redesign is to provide services in a more efficient and effective manner.
We've been really focusing on three components of the social service redesign project, one around process, one around structure, and one around culture. And those three things really interact together. You can't fix one without fixing the other.
Jones says the focus is on a pilot project called the Child Protection and Assessment Redesign.
And being able to have more timeliness and more accurate child protection assessments than we've had previously, but using that as an opportunity to start to learn to change the culture within that process about how do we subordinate to children and families, how do we do what's best for them, and build the process then out of that.
Jones says he hopes that will be a building block to continue the redesign work. He says he hopes to have a proposal for the 2019 legislature. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra kicks off its 94th season on September 22nd at 7:30 p.m. The concert will include pieces by Debussy, Igor Stravinsky, popular Hungarian composer Franz Liszt, and more. Tickets available online at MinotSymphony.com or by phone at 701-858-4228. All performances will be on campus at the Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. The Minot Symphony season opener, September 22nd.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Lisa Vig. She is a counselor at Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Lisa is also the program director of the Gambler's Choice and Gambler Healing Program at Lutheran Social Services. And also in studio with me is a woman we'll call Andy, who went through the Gambling Addiction Recovery Program available through LSS. Andy, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me today.
And we are here primarily to talk about an online program available for people looking for help for gambling addictions. Why online?
Well, there is a lot of concern about individuals with gambling addictions who are not reaching out for help. It is an addiction that's often very hidden. It's secretive. It carries with it a lot of shame and a lot of stigma because of the fact that it involves finances. It's often misunderstood by people in the general public. If you hear of someone talking about gambling episodes where they lost a lot of money, we tend to say something like, well, why didn't you leave? Why did you keep playing when you were losing? What's wrong with you? Don't you have any willpower? We liken it to character issues if we find out that people are having consequences because of a gambling problem.
We like to ask very judgy questions.
Yes, we do. And for that reason, there's a lot of people that do not seek help. A study done nationally in 2016 indicated that about 0.25% of individuals struggling are reaching out for help. So there are many people who are suffering in silence, who are feeling misunderstood, and who are not receiving the kind of support and help that they need. And we find that true in North Dakota as well. We have limited counselors available.
Three in the state.
That's correct. Three in the state to serve thousands of people. A survey done in North Dakota in the winter of 2016-2017 showed that there are about 4,200 people in North Dakota who have clearly identified gambling addictions. However, on the spectrum of individuals who are experiencing problems because of gambling, gambling beyond social gambling, what we would say is safe and fun and recreational, the number is about 28,000. And we are treating about 150 gamblers a year. That's the number that's reaching out for help.
There's a huge gap.
That's a huge gap. We're a rural state, so we also recognize that maybe the three counselors or support group meetings are not readily available to people in a rural area. And so we wanted to really address that concern to make some more services and treatment and support available for people. And so the online program called Gambler Healing was created.
Andy, before we go into how the online program works, Lisa mentioned, you know, there's sort of a stigma, there's an embarrassment, and there's a lack of adequate resources when it comes to helping this. How much of that rings true for your own story?
It rings very true. It was a very helpless and hopeless position to be in, to have spent your last dollar and still be scraping for another quarter or another dollar. I do agree that people do not understand it maybe the same way or treat it the same way that they do drug addiction or an alcohol addiction. Just like anything else, there's help available. And I hope through this process we're able to get the word out to some people.
Well, I noticed in watching part of the online program, there is a group therapy program that eventually did become a DVD, which sort of led to the creation of the online program. And one of the first questions, Lisa, that you throw out there is, what did you like about gambling? So, Andy, what do you like about gambling? What did you like about gambling?
Well, I'll start by telling you that I am college educated with a family and four children, and I felt like at that point in my life I lost a little bit of myself. I didn't understand fully who I was, being pulled in so many directions with children and daily things going on. I found a sense of who I was and quiet and peace in the gambling. Until it wasn't peaceful and it wasn't quiet anymore. It was a struggle. It was a lot of not telling the whole truth about where the money was going.
Yeah. Lisa, that makes so much sense to me. And I'm only the mother of one.
It does.
And finding that calm and
yes,
that control. So
Andy's
important.
Experience is very common, especially with women. Gambling is a place for a mini vacation. When you're sitting in front of a slot machine, you're opening pull tabs, you're playing bingo, you're, you know, telling yourself you're doing a little bit of socializing with other people, you're getting out of the house, you're doing something for yourself that's positive. And for a while, it does feel good. But for those individuals who begin to rely on gambling as a way of coping, as a way of dealing with loneliness or loss of purpose or exhaustion or some grief, it could be a variety of things. If gambling becomes the place where we go to hide and to escape and to avoid facing those issues, it can be a very dark and lonely and dangerous place. And that's part of, I think, why people have difficulty reaching out for help.
Why does your therapy program, or at least what's available online, start with that question? What did you like about gambling?
Well, I think it gives us a lot of clues as to the reinforcement that an individual experienced when they were gambling. Andy's experience about feeling a sense of peace or calm or some sense of control, having a little break from day-to-day responsibilities, is one often heard experience. The other situation that we often hear about is a feeling of excitement and energy and adrenaline and powerful control and ego, that it helps to provide this sense of purpose and this sense of just well-being for individuals. And so if we can help them identify what was gambling providing for them in the addiction, it gives us clues to maybe some things that are missing for them in their life. And those are important components when we talk about them living their life without gambling. Because, for instance, Andy will need to work on other ways of finding peace and calm and relaxation and other ways of dealing with stress, parenting, and relationship issues. That's the part of how we help people continue to be gambling free, is by solving some of those problems, solving some of those questions, and giving them new tools to carry on in their new life.
The online program is at gamblerhealing.com, and it is available through Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota, one of the developing agencies behind the program. Lisa, how does the online program work?
Well, it's really, I think it's very unique. The online program has several components. It covers the 12 steps of a healing program that we often refer to in a support group setting, 12 steps of recovery. And so the 12 steps are broken down into different modules. There is group discussions held on those steps. You will actually listen and watch group discussions about the 12 steps of recovery. There are opportunities to journal, so you have an opportunity to share some personal responses, to do some personal reflection. There are opportunities to read out of a day-at-a-time meditation book, which is specifically focused on gambling and recovery. And there's also some opportunities to hear comments from a licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Stephen Timm, who participated in the online program, creating the online program, by offering some professional comments about addiction, about recovery, about spirituality, about making amends from his psychological perspective. And those are the things that we actually do in our real-life treatment program at Gambler's Choice, when people come together for a group and they complete assignments and they share and they learn from one another. We tried to recreate that in an online setting.
Mm-hmm. I know that clients have the ability to reach out and ask for more one-on-one help in the program. I'm wondering, is there anybody monitoring some of these responses and saying, I think we do need to reach out to this person, and you can be the one who establishes contact?
The online program can be used a couple of different ways. It can be used by an individual kind of as a self-help. If someone is wondering if they have a gambling problem and wondering if they should do something about it, this would be a place for them to start. And it can be done in the privacy of their own home, where they have an opportunity to share and write and journal confidentially. If they want to believe that this is a problem for me and I do need to reach out for additional help, they can reach out to a counselor at Gambler's Choice. And they can choose to share the password for their online treatment program, and those answers mm-hmm. then can be viewed by the counselor, and they can share feedback with one another, and the counselor can offer some structure and some guidance and some support. So it can be used confidentially by an individual. Mm-hmm. It can also be used in conjunction with a counselor.
Okay, but the counselors wouldn't necessarily be monitoring it without that password.
Right. Yes, it's up to the client to share those answers if they so choose.
Okay. Andy, I want to talk to you about the 12 steps, because so often when we hear stories of addiction and recovery, there are false starts. Is this the first time were you successful, the first time you sought treatment, or is this
I have been
third
successful.
Or fourth
this
time?
Is my first try.
Congratulations.
I continue to try to maintain this clean new way of living every day. So it's a commitment that I make over and over and over. And when there are hard days, I might make that commitment several times during the day.
Yeah. I notice you are holding the meditation book that they mention in the program.
I am.
There are certainly situations where you might want to spend more time in one of the 12 steps than the other?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know what some of those are? Can you give us examples?
Of the 12 steps?
Of times that you feel the most need to revisit parts of the program.
Well, I know Lisa mentioned control, and that was one thing I was lacking, I think, being a mother and a wife and working in day-to-day things.
Disappears fast.
Mm-hmm. When I was approached by my husband and told flat out that this is a problem, this gambling is a problem, the first thing I had to do was admit that I was powerless. Mm. And, you know, the main, the front of our book says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I think that saying puts the power back in my heart, in my soul, and it refreshes me, and I'm able to go forward, work on my program, continue with the 12 steps. And the 12th, I think, having been clean from gambling for 3 years, the 12th, I think, is the most important for me now, because I continue to help others and bring awareness to others.
Lisa, this 12-step program, we hear about 12 steps in lots of different roads to recovery. Why do those 12 steps work?
I think the 12 steps are kind of a miracle way of living. And I think the 12 steps really apply to everyone. You don't have to be struggling with an addiction to have these 12 steps be a powerful impact in your life. For instance, the first step talks about being powerless and unmanageable. We are all powerless and unmanageable in certain aspects of our life. And the steps 2 and 3 talk about a higher power and allowing a higher power to influence our life and to turn our will and our life over to the care of a higher power. The 12 steps teach us about promptly admitting when we've made a wrong, making an amend, taking opportunities every day to reflect back on our behavior and make changes in the next day, to reach out of ourselves to help make other people better and do what we can to show care and concern for others. The 12 steps are a marvelous blueprint for living. And the fact that they help people overcome addictions is an amazing miracle. And we know they work. We know that they are providing healing and a whole new way of living for millions of people around the country. And if you are wondering if a 12-step program would benefit you, I would say don't give up. If you feel like it hasn't helped you or it didn't help you at that particular time, try again. Try a different meeting. Try visiting with different people who have used a 12-step program in their life, mm-hmm. and find how it has worked for them and what they have done to make it work and be successful.
Andy, on the website, and again, it's gamblerhealing.com, one of the key early steps is to honestly evaluate your situation. Self-reporting is notoriously unreliable. Do you feel like when you were first going through this that you were able to be honest from the get-go, or what helped you to be able to provide honest
That's
answers?
That's a good question. What gave me the ability to answer honestly? I think Lisa mentioned fellowship. The hardest thing an addict will have to do is reach out for help that first time, whether it's going online, admitting it to someone else, or walking into a meeting. And I always tell people that is the hardest step. You've done that step. Now let the healing begin. I did keep a journal when I started, or when I started my new clean path. I started a journal, and the milestones that I was making, spending money, were counted by how many loans do we have to take out? How many, you know, how do we save our house, our skin? Yeah. So it got bad. It got to the point where I was at the end. I was at the bottom.
Do you want to share how much money?
A lot. Yeah. You know, and in the meetings, in our Gamblers Choice and Gamblers Anonymous meetings, we don't usually go into certain amounts just because then it kind of becomes a grading system or a competition. You know,
sure.
How much money did you spend? Well, I didn't spend that much, so maybe I'm not as much of an addict as Fred over
sure.
there.
Not but, very productive mm-hmm. then.
Right.
Yeah.
But you have a certain level of accountability to your group, and you feel that right away because when you walk in, there is no judgment. You are welcomed. You are on a level playing field. Everybody is there to help the new person.
We are visiting with Lisa Vig. She is a counselor with Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota with the Gambler's Choice Program, and with a woman named Andy who went through the program, and specifically talking about an online application where people can remain anonymous until they choose to not remain anonymous if they feel like it, and that is available at gamblerhealing.com. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share about this unique program.
And Andy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on your successes.
Yes, thank you. And I'm wishing the same for many other people.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Pray Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
We asked some of our sustaining members why they support Prairie Public.
I'm Dina Butcher from Bismarck, North Dakota. The news, morning, afternoon, and evening, Thomas Jefferson Hour is always a treat. But Main Street is also always of interest because of the topical nature of the people they interview. It's my zen place, away from the shrill shouting noise on commercial broadcasting. I am proud to have been a part of StoryCorps with my daughter and grandson, and so many people, strangers, have commented to me that that was a driveway moment for them. And for that, I commend the amazing staff, the editors, who were able to take 40 minutes and concentrate it down to 3 and 6 minute segments. It's such a value for whatever contribution you would want to make. I've been a sustaining member for a number of years, and I think I'm a charter member. It's a great value.
You can support the programs you love on Pray Public by becoming a sustaining member. It's easy. Just go to praypublic.org, call 800-359-4145, or text the word support to 484848 and click on the link.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 12th. The Marquis de Moores cultivated a short-lived cattle empire during his time in Dakota Territory, but a long-running murder allegation also defined his time out west. De Moores wasn't popular in the Badlands. He had enemies who despised him for everything from how he acquired his land to his ambitious cattle operation to his development of Medora, even xenophobia. After all, he was a French aristocrat, not from these parts. But when the Marquis fenced his land, that really lit the fuse. One of his worst enemies was Frank O'Donnell. Frank was a hunter who shared a claim on the Little Missouri River with Riley Lufsey and Dutch Wanigan. They were furious about the fences, which they considered an infringement on their rights. Time and again, the fence wires were cut, only to be replaced. Then there was gunplay. A few sporadic shots leading up to a nighttime shootout surrounding the Chateau de Moores. On June 26, 1883, the hostility climaxed in a fatal gunfight outside Medora between O'Donnell's group and Damore's and his men. Luffsee died, shot in the throat and chest. What happened next began a running legal battle for the Marquis. Murder charges against Damore's were dismissed twice in 1883, but on this date in 1885, the matter finally went to trial in Bismarck before District Judge William F. Francis. The indictment by a grand jury charged Damore's with Luffsee's murder. The Marquis asked for a change of venue from Mandan to Bismarck, partly because he believed Irish Mandan residents would sympathize with Luffsee, who was also Irish. The judge granted the change of venue, and the jury trial began with a gallery full of spectators. District Attorney T.K. Long rehashed the previous charges and also Damore's history as a duelist, having had killed two opponents. The judge found Long's arguments so far out of line that the attorney was found in contempt of court. Long was jailed and fined $250. He had alleged that the judge and the Marquis's lawyer were too cozy, noting that the defense attorney had once clerked for the judge. After the week-long trial, the jury had the case and returned from deliberation after 10 minutes with a verdict: not guilty. There were lynch threats, and a friend of the Marquis reportedly slipped him a pistol. He returned to Medora, to his supporters and his detractors, and the case was finally closed. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Politics is the story we're all binging on, and we'll be the ones to decide how it comes out this November. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Join me each Monday through Thursday for a national conversation from WNYC about the issues that matter most to voters in every corner of the country. We'll hear from candidates, activists, and from you in our live news and call-in program, America on the Line.
NPR's new live call-in show, America on the Line, airs Monday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This storm is a monster.
Millions are evacuating.
It's big.
As a powerful hurricane makes its way toward the Carolinas.
And it's vicious.
And officials prepare for a potentially life-threatening storm surge.
Even if you've ridden out storms before, this one is different.
Bracing for Hurricane Florence. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, a conference that is designed to help people who provide resources and help for foster care children. It is called the Therapeutic Partners in Child Welfare Conference, and we learn more from Charlie Joyce, a social worker and presenter at the conference. Sue Balcom joins us for a discussion about canning, and we have our What's Happening calendar of events. That's coming up tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.